And so really everything I'm writing about is to try to return to whatever's authentic and has integrity. I think that's the wealth of life.
I think it's been, what, 6-7 months since we last talked?
Yeah, and I've enjoyed just the diversity of your guests on Leafbox. And I'm always heartened and amazed by the variety of people you find. And that itself amazes me because, you know, it's hard to find people that are outside of sort of like the funnel that we're fed.
I think we can talk about that funnel later in the conversation. Thank you for your positive feedback. Yeah, a lot of listeners of our first podcast emailed me saying, hey, when are you going to do a second with Charles? And I thought that would be a good time to reconnect. So I appreciate you doing this. Well, Charles, I think I wanted to start actually with a positive note. I just saw your email this morning on the doom loop in cities across the US and the West. But before we go there, I really took to heart that quote you wrote, that it's better to have a 30-person network than a 30-room bunker. So maybe we can start there and what motivated that essay. And
well, thank you for bringing that topic up. And I think like everything else I'm interested in or try to write about, multi-layered. And I think perhaps the core foundational layer of that essay is the idea that there's authenticity and that our authenticity in the way we live has been eroded in ways that it's hard for us to even notice. The idea of community, like so many other things, it's a word and it's an idea and it's been watered down or co-opted into something that's essentially meaningless. So you see this many references to community, you know, like, well, we're helping our community and exactly what does that mean? And so it turns out that it's become an abstraction in so many ways and for so many people. What I was kind of aiming for in that essay is the idea of like, well, let's reestablish what authentic community means. And what it means is there are 30 people who care about you in some way. Now, they may not even know your name. They may just wave to you as neighbors, but you're connected through a network, people who do care about each other and are willing to do something, take some action to express that caring. And then that's another degradation of authenticity that we've had this idea that social media and somebody clicking on the like button somehow a substitute for real community. And not to say that there isn't some sort of community in social media, but it's not a replacement for the kind of an authentic community.
I wonder, you know, living in the Big Island, have you heard of Zuckerberg's Kawaii projects?
Yeah. And in fact, that is what motivated me to write about the 30-room bunker is Mark Zuckerberg's bunker that he's building on Kauai.
Yeah, for listeners, could you maybe summarize what he's doing and what you think the flaws or benefits of his project are or some of the dynamics in Hawaii and how that influences your writing?
Yeah, well, that's a great topic. And I don't claim to be an expert. I don't live on Kauai. I have visited a few times. But I think the way I would contextualize what Zuckerberg and other billionaires are doing, if we go back in time, several generations, we can say, well, there was always wealthy people and there was always working class people and a middle class, you know, that had more security than the working class and so on. All of this was already present. So we think that there's a continuity between the present and the past because of this sort of basic class structure still exists. And that's not actually the case. The continuity has been broken. And what used to happen generations ago was a wealthy family would come in from the mainland and they would buy a beachfront property and build, you know, some nice house, right? That this was the standard model. Now, the billionaire class doesn't just have a beachfront property or a mansion. They're buying hundreds or thousands of acres of land that has been removed from the local economy. Now, they can make claims that they're protecting it from development and so on and so forth. And some of these ideas or claims may actually have some validity, right? Because the billionaire doesn't need to build 1,000 condos to support paying $400 million for the property, but doesn't really describe the dynamic, what's changed, which is the billionaire now has tremendous leverage over not just the political system, because of course they have the money to buy influence. They also own big chunks of the actual island. And in this sense, it's sort of like going back to the days of the Big Five, referring to five large corporations that owned significant chunks of whatever private land was available. And they were the dominant political influences in the pre-state economy and you know, say up to the 1960s or so. And so the billionaire class is not even a corporation, it's individuals. And so, and I think it's very indicative of their mindset. Zuckerberg, the other billionaires in the class, seek to create bunker fortress mentality as if they understand they're hated and loathed and they're on the wrong side of history. So they feel compelled to do is create a fortress, physical fortress, to protect themselves from the outside world catching on to their game, so to speak. And so this is remarkably divergent from like a real community. In other words, like it's almost like difficult for us to imagine a billionaire who chose to live in a community. Obviously, they'd have to have security guards because they can't have their kids kidnapped for ransom and that kind of thing. Their visibility creates certain barriers, but they could, in fact, live at a scale very similar to the rest of us. And they could contribute to their local community by not buying huge chunks of the island and not, you know, exerting political controls. And yet they choose not to do that. And so this is what makes it different from the old days, I think. And so to kind of repeat the idea that community can be authentic, the idea is that if community is just based on a hierarchy of money, and how many layers of protection there is between you and the rest of the populace, I think that's the antithesis of community. The actual community is the people who live around the edges of Zuckerberg's empire, who are trying to make a living on an island that is increasingly dominated by short-term vacation rental ownership, where the money goes somewhere other than the island of Kauai. And all the negative effects of that kind of exposure to global capital, like all of the islands of Hawaii are limited in space, and the population is limited, and our biosphere is limited. And then this is now for sale, essentially, on one level or another, to global capital, which has access to essentially trillions of dollars, you know, aggregate. And so there's no way that the local community can muster up, at least at the capital level, any sort of equivalency to what global capital can do. They can access literally $300-400 million without any problem at all. How do we deal with this? And it's like, we don't have a lot of tools because capital is mobile and it's fluid. So capital flows around the world with a few keystrokes, but we as humans and as laborers, as workers, we're in one place in the world, and we can move that place, but at enormous expense and effort. And so those of us who are trying to, you know, who look at people, the residents, as the core of community, then it's like, well, what's being lost in ceding ownership to the billionaire class? And how does that impact our ability to care about our own neighbors? And so sort of to summarize, I think when push comes to shove, In a social crisis, it's really, you're more protected by having people who care about you and are willing to make some sacrifices on your behalf than your ability to hire armed guards and set a perimeter like basically a base camp in Iraq.
Charles, have you read the book Survival of the Richest? I think it's by Douglas Ruckoff. He writes this book about the escape fantasies of, quote, tech billionaires.
I haven't read the book, but I've read his essays on it. And I've had a podcast with Douglas. I admire him a lot. But yeah, I'm familiar with his thesis and how he was consulted,
Yeah, I think when your essay you wrote about it, I mean, you know, you were one of the Flatlanders when you grew up. And in Kauai, I always think about if something really were to happen, I mean, his compound would be raided very quickly. And it's funny because in the Douglas Ruckoff book, he talks about how billionaires, they strategize all day trying to figure out how to control their guards from mutiny. So it's a very interesting dynamic. And I just want to take listeners, yes, the 30 people you know seems more valuable than, you know, having 30 homes or whatnot at this point, you know, if you're really worried about a collapse scenario.
Well, you picked up on those themes and wrote, I thought, a beautiful and moving commentary about your experience with community gardens as a real world example of how community works. And what I found so interesting was not only the attention to the beautiful aspects of community gardens and the sharing, but you also mentioned the fact that things are messy. You know, people have different views of what should be in the garden, and you know, human life is messy. And in communities, we understand this, and we there's give and take. And what we find when we lose the real community, authentic community, and we've substituted a digital form, then disagreement gets you more likes, and you get more audience, and therefore more income by being more disagreeable rather than being like more flexible. And as we do when we actually deal with people on a day-to-day real world basis, you know, in other words, there's give and take in the community garden. And what I think of as community is another layer of it is if you're a productive person in any way, shape or form, and I don't mean necessarily making money. I mean, being productive and doing something useful in human life. This can be taking care of elderly people, taking care of children. This can be raising food in your yard or your community garden. It can be being able to help somebody, you know, fix their, you know, technical problem. And there's lots of levels of productivity. But if you're able to create a surplus that then you can share with other people without any concern for what you're getting back, in other words, it's not your livelihood. You don't have to enter the market where there's a price and a cost and, you know, supply and demand. And, you know, you can leave all that aside, because I think the market in itself is like another form of distortion that we've lost sight of, is that now a part of neoliberalism as a general view of capitalism and the way the world should work or does work is the idea that everything becomes better if we can turn it into a market in which there's a price for everything and everything becomes a commodity that can be traded globally. Then there's supply and demand, and then those gain and profit are the become the core motivator, incentive, and measure of everything. And so if you can leave all that aside and just say, I have extra food that I've grown, and here, let me find somebody in around where I live or my friends or family who can use it. And if I can't find somebody that can use it directly, find somebody who can give it to somebody they know. In other words, the extended network. And we talk about in sociology, they use like strong ties and weak ties to describe our social connections. The power of weak ties, in other words, the people that your friends and family and neighbors know, you might know them without really knowing them. In other words, you wave to them, you say hi to them when you see them at your neighbor's house, and or you've heard their name, you know the connection of your cousin to this person. But those people actually turn out to be quite important in our lives. And in other words, even the person that you wave to on your morning walk, or the guy selling hot dogs on the corner or whatever, even if they're not personal, intimate friends, we actually gain a tremendous amount of social stability, mental health, if you will, from having that extended network. And that's part of the community that we've kind of lost, I think, because we're staring at our phones and screens all the time. To kind of wrap that up, the idea that community is creating a surplus and sharing it with other people, and the reciprocity is voluntary. We're not demanding a price. It's not a market transaction. I think that's the core of community, non-market transactions, where you're giving freely because you want to share what you have or you want to help somebody. And then they want to respond and reciprocate. And if they don't, if they're incapable of responding, like they're blind to the reciprocity of community, then eventually people give up on him and they become isolated. So you have to reciprocate, and that's what community is too, reciprocity. But it's all voluntary. It's not like there's a market transaction, or we think of it as some market transaction that doesn't happen to have any money. No, it's not a market transaction at all.
So Charles, maybe jumping up a layer, you know, we're at the community garden where, you know, you can easily meet 30 people and give back and forth. Let's jump to your essay that you just published today on the doom loops of cities and what your thesis is there and how that might offer a contrast or how you look at that problem.
Yeah, that's a great topic. And I appreciate you allowing me to talk about it in a similar way. I think we're talking about impact of finance and markets and the way that it distorts our individual lives, and it distorts large structures such as cities. This I think what I was trying to describe in talking about the doom loop was there's an idea that there's like a natural economy, and people can describe it in very many ways. You can talk about it as early capitalism, or there was commerce long before we say capitalism emerged. But there was commerce in 3000 BC, right? There was a very active commerce in the Bronze Age, several thousand years BC. And so I think what we're talking about with cities is there's a natural purpose for cities. We can trace that very easily to just geography and transportation. Like, cities arose on conjunctions of rivers, or where rivers met a sea or a lake, and then there's a bay or a harbor, and they were conducive to trade and becoming centers of commerce, which would be manufacturing, it would be warehousing, and all the ancillary elements of those sort of core economic functions of human life, right? And so the question is, do cities fulfill those roles now or not? And there's two primary influences to that. One is, of course, technology, which has emptied out some of that, the value of cities as places where physical activity takes place. So in other words, people don't have to go to the office anymore. So then therefore they're not going to buy lunch. The business is in the business district, right? So there's that element. But there's also what we call financialization, which is that the dominance of finance over everything else in our lives. And this is a process that, again, like the sort of erosion of community, it's occurred without us really noticing. Like, most people just take it for granted that finance dominates every decision. Like, every decision, whether it's political, economic, or social, it all boils down to, well, where's the money coming from? Who controls it? What's the rate of interest? Is there free money for some class and not free money for some other class? And like, how do we profit from the sort of flow of finance? And so cities seem to me to have become, their core function is now just as mechanisms of finance. In other words, the city finances, draws its income from the flow of capital. And so that it doesn't, there's no manufacturing in American cities to speak of anymore. And there's really not much warehousing either. I mean, the Amazon distribution centers are spread around and they're close to transportation hubs, but those are not necessarily in cities anymore because cities are expensive. So you build your distribution center out someplace in the middle of nowhere. What's the core function of the city now? The answer that's being told by the civic leaders and pundits is essentially entertainment. In other words, you live in a city because it's entertaining. There's nightclubs and you can buy it, you can have delivery, to your apartment, with security, so you don't have to worry about street crime or anything because you're behind a protected wall. And then there's the delivery service gets in, but nobody else does. And so, and fine dining and, culture. And it's all like, well, certainly cities have always been concentrations of political power because the leaders had to meet somewhere, right? So Rome was the center of the empire. Now it was a distributed empire, meaning that that had nodes. Many of the cities in the Roman Empire were political centers of power where the leadership gathered, right? Whether it's secular or religious or political, the leadership met in person. This was required, right? Now that's not the case, but it's the cities were always a center of political power and then financial power because the money was stored there and the money changed hands there. And it was a physical, you know, the physical wealth. In other words, this was where all the goods were stored and distributed from here. So if the cities don't perform any of those functions, then what's left? And then what's left is, when you read sort of the current media, is entertainment. Well, it's just more fun to live in the city. And so you go, okay, that's legitimate. You know, humans like fun. They like novelty. They like that personal interaction of being in a restaurant or a nightclub or going to a theater. All those are valuable, but is that enough to support a city, which is an enormously expensive operation? And so that's the question I'm raising. And I don't have an answer, except I don't think that fine dining condominiums with delivery services, I don't think that's enough to support a city. And I don't really think that's the core ideal of what a city is. But I'm not sure we have a substitute once the city loses its economic foundational purpose, or that those diminish to the point where there's a container harbor with it's highly automated. And so there's a few hundred jobs where there used to be tens of thousands. Is that enough to support the whole region? You know, a few hundred jobs in a container port? I don't think so. That's an open question, I guess.
One of the topics, I mean, there's two questions I have. Are you familiar with Randall O'Toole's The Anti-Planner? He writes a lot about these issues about urban planning and actual individual choices. So my question, I guess, is where do you think people should live then? Do you want them? Are you recommending they go to more rural places to keep living in cities? What can an individual take away from your goal? Should they get on the planning commission? Should they actively escape the city, try to improve the city? What do you offer as advice to individuals?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I'm going to, again, try to answer it on a couple different levels. I think one of the issues with cities is that the global mobility of capital and talent it's a dual-edged sword. I've had a reader tell me, well, this is the era of the supremacy of the individual, in that a talented, ambitious, credentialed, or knowledgeable individual can go and around the world. They have a lot of options about where they're going to physically work or live because they have this skill set that's valued by the sort of tech finance rulers or, you know, masters of the universe. And so as individuals, they don't need a community or a city per se. And so their interest in it is like therefore abstract and very shallow. In other words, you can fly in to any major city in the world, and there's a beautiful airport, you know, if it's a developed world, and you get off and you have all the same services. You know, it's called, you know, Uber in the US and something else in China and something else in Thailand and so on. But it's like global capital has kind of homogenized the entire world in a lot of ways. And so if you're just an individual that's thrilled to go live in Shanghai for a few months a year, then you go back to New York, or you have your haven in the Caribbean or whatever. And I'm not denigrating these people. I mean, in a way, I'm living that life too. You know, I have skills that allow me to work remotely. End of story. I mean, so I have to be careful not to be too hypocritical. But it's sort of like, where are you in the world that you're going to want to contribute to the civic life if you're just there for a few months or a year or whatever, and then you're off to the next homogenized global capital? And then so I think that, and it's not just the remote workers flitting around the world, it's also true even in like the continental US that people move a huge amount now, you know, that you're constantly being moved around to advance your career, you know. And so then people are like, quote, stuck someplace because they can't leave because their spouse's health insurance is the only insurance they can get. And if they quit, they have no health care coverage, which is a catastrophe in and of itself in the United States, or that their mortgages that they've got a 3% mortgage and they can't sell because then they'd have to pay 7% and they can't afford it. So there's this whole mix of like who's mobile and who's stuck. And if the people are mobile, either forced to be mobile, to be constantly moving around because their corporation shifted them, or they closed the headquarters in Seattle and moved it to Chicago or whatever, then how do you keep any civic ties? How do you have the time, energy, or caring to like contribute to the kind of thing you mentioned, like being on the planning commission or something? It's like, well, you can't. And then the way that work has dominated, again, part of the whole thing of like the dominance of finance is like work now dominates people's lives in ways that we've lost track of. That by the time you get back from work, or whether you finally turn the screen off at home, you're drained. You're physically, mentally, emotionally, psychologically drained by what was demanded of you to keep your job or be productive in a market economy. So what do you have left to give to anything in your community or city? And it turns out for many people that it's like nothing. So they're like passive observers of what goes on around them. So there's that element. And so then the civic energy requires people to be permanent or semi-permanent. They need to have lived there long enough to care about it. Or ideally, the traditional model would be they've lived there for three generations, you know, their grandparents and their parents, and they live in the same city or neighborhood, right? And so if you lose all that, if it's eroded by all these different forces, including unaffordability, like now young people can't even afford to own a home in most of urban America, well, then what kind of population do you have? And if they have nothing left to contribute to the city, well, then the city's lost something intangible that's core to its existence. So there's that element. And then I also want to mention, you've probably seen these statistics. I just saw something that said 7 million people in the greater New York City area want to leave. And then the number in the San Francisco Bay Area is something like, I'm guessing I read 40% want to move. It might have even been higher, might have been 60%. Some enormous percentage of the population is dissatisfied, and at least in their fantasies would like to move. And so then you go, well, where are you going to move these millions of people? You know, and so then we look back at history and we go, well, what happened over the last 100 years or 200 years? Well, what happened is people that lived in rural communities moved to cities because that's where the jobs were. And that's still the case, right? As a general rule, the urban metropolitan areas are where the wealth and the jobs concentrate. And so there's lots of abandoned or hollowed out villages in Japan, in Italy, in France, and in the US. Thousands of villages and small towns have been hollowed out, right? As people left because they couldn't make a living there, you know? And so again, the dominance of finance and then agriculture, which used to be the foundation of human life, is now like literally 1% of the jobs in America are related to agriculture, or 2%, you know, and then 40% have to do with finance, and another 40% have to do with digital transactions, essentially.
Charles, you seem critical of, I guess, what I would call the global managerial class that doesn't have strong ties. You don't seem to write much about migration, let's say at the other end of the economic ladder, and how that affects, you know, the housing stock. Or do you find those forces the same forces, the financialization? They just want more labor to lower costs. And I mean, a Marxist lens would be that they want more immigration to lower the cost of labor, and then to increase, you know, with the limited supply of housing, then you're actually increasing the price of the housing stock. So I'm just curious, you don't seem to write much about migration in your essays. So I'm curious what you think about it and how it affects these forces and kind of the social ties and things.
Yeah, actually, I think that's a very good point. And I don't mean to sound negative about migration or immigration. I think what I'm foreseeing is that as we saw, like the migration from rural to urban because of the forces of money, essentially, and work, then we might see a reverse migration. Smaller towns and cities that might have more affordable housing and might have a better quality of life, which is, of course, the whole selling point of the city. Set aside the economic functions of a city and just look at the benefits and costs of living in a city. The benefits are the cultural richness and the opportunities for entertainment and community and all that, gatherings and the cultural opportunities in a city are higher than in the countryside. And so there may be a migration driven by seeking a better balance between like these extremely large metropolitan areas and smaller cities that have some cultural benefits and some liveliness, but that they don't have the same costs as the megalopolises. Migration is sort of a core freedom in human life. In other words, you vote with your feet. I think that's kind of what we may be witnessing is people voted with their feet to leave the village and the town because they wanted, there was more opportunity in the big city. So over the last 100 years, then the population of the developed world and the developing world both have concentrated into the cities. And now these dynamics that we're discussing may lead to a reversal of that migration, that cities may lose population as people seek a better balance, like a place where they can afford to buy a house and yet still have the benefits of an urban environment.
So is your advice then to the individuals to just move with their feet, or what do you advise them then? Because if they have strong ties to, say, San Francisco or Los Angeles, but what's the solution for that?
Yeah, and I don't, I'm very wary of giving advice other than what seems abstract or general, but each person's situation is so complex and complicated that it's each person has to make up their own mind. And so my advice is just to kind of focus on how do you regain as much control as you can over your own life? And this is the core of what I term self-reliance. I talk about self-reliance and it's often confused in many people's minds with self-sufficiency. Like they think, I mean, you should have a homestead and live off the land, etc. That may be part of a solution for you, but it may not. And so self-reliance is not necessarily self-sufficiency. It's more like taking back the control over our lives that's been lost to a lot of different things, technology and finance being two. And so however you can regain control over your life, then that's what I would recommend. If that may be staying exactly where you are, it may just be changing other things in your life, possibly even just the intangible parts of your life. Or it could mean deciding that the balance of life between risk and return and cost and benefit no longer favors where you are. And so then you're forced to move. And where to move becomes like a challenge, of course. And what we see these shifts in population as people make up their own minds what works best for them. So since you and I both live in Hawaii, we can use Hawaii as an example. Hawaii has been losing population, and there is now more Native Hawaiian people with Native Hawaiian ethnic backgrounds in Las Vegas than there is in the state of Hawaii. At least this is what we've been told, because you can buy a house, you can afford a house in Las Vegas, and there's jobs, entertainment, and lodging, hospitality sector. So that's been an out migration that's totally individually controlled. Like there is no state agency or mandating that people move to Vegas. It's totally driven by the forces that have made housing unaffordable in Hawaii for non-wealthy residents. And then there's this other migration, which is like wealthy remote worker types who are coming to Hawaii because they are rich enough, they can afford to buy a house, and then they can make money here in the global market economy. They're not limited to what the actual physical jobs in Hawaii. So these are examples of the kind of migration that are occurring, that as people try to figure out what works for them. And I can tell you that here on the Big Island, that the district of Puna, the Big Island is, of course, the largest island by far. And there are thousands and thousands of lots, undeveloped, you know, housing lots that were subdivided in the 60s without paved roads or utilities. And so there's a lot of land on the Big Island that you can still buy a lot for like $20,000. And if you're handy or you have friends, you can build some kind of really modest shelter there. And so or you can buy a regular house and it'll be worth $300,000 or $400,000. In this state, that's dirt cheap, right? And so people are flooding into Puna because it's that's the last place in the entire state where a normal household can afford to buy a house. And so what's happening is that there's tens of thousands of new residents over the course of, let's say, the last 20 years in Puna, and it's still served by two-lane roads. And so it's created this urban congestion in a non-urban setting. And so I'm just mentioning all of these dynamics are in play. And I, again, my only recommendation to people is enhance your self-reliance and control of your own life and destiny by whatever means you have available and whatever works for you.
Charles, one of the great advice I took from one of your other essays is about the concept of going gray. And I think that's a good point to kind of bounce off what you just said about the Big Island. Could you expand on your concept of what you mean by going gray? And I guess you could term it as local averaging versus surrender, and how that fits into your concept of self-reliance.
Yeah, thank you for that question, because I wrote about going gray, and it's a concept that's been around for a while. It was called gray man, which of course we I don't want to favor it. Gray person. I mean, I don't know. You know, it's like, so just going gray means anybody, not just just men. And so the idea is that you blend in, and so you don't get a target on your back by driving a luxury car and going to your gated community or your bunker. Because as you pointed out, if things get dicey, flagrantly displaying the fact that you're wealthy and have all kinds of neat stuff that can be stolen, that's not necessarily a wise policy, unless you want to be a target. Most people don't. So there's that element. And the idea of we're living in a total spectrum, you know, we can call it like a full spectrum surveillance society, in which corporations and the government sort of both and together as one system are constantly monitoring and collecting data on us digitally. And so we there's various forms of this. I mean, China has its social credit system with, you know, millions of cameras on every, you know, light pole and so on. So, you know, they've centralized it in the hands of the government. In the U.S., it's kind of split between corporations who are constantly collecting data on you, whether you are aware of it or not. And then that's being shared or sold to the government. The idea being, if you want to just not stick out and become a target for controls might be exerted, then you just want to look average. So you drive an average looking car, and I joke that, you know, you post photos of kittens and puppies on your Facebook page and, you know, that kind of thing. It's like you just look like everybody else. And so it's partly like a survival technique, if you will. I was criticized, or some readers said, well, you're telling me to be passive. And no, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to fight for my rights and, you know, the Constitution. And I failed to explain myself well enough that I didn't mean to be passive in saying going gray. It's more like go local, as you intuited. You know, it's like turn your activity into like your local community, like where you physically are, and do what you can there to regain control of your life, as opposed to getting involved in high profile conflicts, if you will, that you know, your efforts might make you a target, but they may not actually help solve the problems that you're concerned about. And so we're much more likely to have some effect in our local community. And so that's kind of what going gray means to me. Now, other people have other interpretations.
It's interesting how you tie the surveillance economy and the control mechanisms to local self-reliance as a way to surrender. Do you ever, what are your thoughts about anonymity? You know, I interviewed a writer recently who's anonymous, and he chooses to be anonymous because he has more freedom. Have you ever considered using a pen name, or how do you feel like there's a censorship of what you potentially write, or how are you going gray, and are there limits to how far you can go in that?
I think it's a very important topic. Let's contextualize it by going back a bit. When the internet started in the late 90s. Now, we know it started back in 1969 with the ARPANET and so on. But for the average person, it became available in like the mid to late 90s with 14.4 modems. And we were all thrilled when we moved to 28.8. And you know, people got on AOL and all this kind of thing. The mass of people moving onto the internet really occurred around the late 90s to the early 2000s. And this was the Wild West of the web. In other words, people did searches, and there were many search engines, AltaVista, Ask Jeeves, so on and so forth. And the idea was that you would go and do web searches, and you would go to individual sites. We didn't call them blogs. They were just websites, right, that were hosted by organizations, individuals, companies, whatever. And so you did your own searching online. Now what happened was that the development of Facebook and Google and Apple and so on, that the tech monopolies or quasi-monopolies have created these platforms that are now we're all funneled into. So people don't really do what we would call organic searching anymore. What happens is they go to platforms. They go to X, you know, Twitter or Facebook or Instagram or YouTube. And then if they go to a search engine, for example, Google, or if you're on Amazon, you're going to search for something on Amazon. The links are all sponsored, which means that people, that individuals or companies are paying these tech monopolies for placement. Where it used to be back in the early days, you would go to Amazon and you would do a search for some product or a book. The search would be what Amazon thought had its algorithms had chosen as the closest to what you were looking for. Now you have to scroll through four pages of sponsored links to get to anything that was so-called organic, right? And the same is true of Google, that Google used to refer to websites and now it provides its own answers, right? So that you stay glued to them and then they get money from that. And so this this raises all sorts of interesting ethical issues as well. Also contextualize it that modern cars, and I don't know, I can't state exactly what year this began, but the cars that are manufactured today collect data on your driving, and not just your location, but your braking and on your basic driving mechanisms. And they send this, they transmit this data to the car's manufacturers, who then sell it to insurance companies. Because it helps them decide whether they should raise your insurance, that if you're driving erratically, they will discover this and then they can raise your rates. And so there are various opt-in policies that are like this. In other words, State Farm, for example, monitoring your car, you get a 10% discount, right? But you don't, the data is being collected, you don't opt in or opt out. You opted in when you bought the car. And so there's lots of data being collected that you can question whether you're anonymous. And so it turns out that really you have to cut off all internet access. You know, you'd have to like have no internet access and have a burner cell phone. And then you could pretty much not be tracked. You're still using utilities, You know, so, you know, it's almost like, is it, at what point do you sacrifice more than you're willing to give up? And if you're going to kind of try to balance it out, you never really get rid of being tracked. And so, for instance, I have friends that have flip phones because they object to, you know, smartphones being like basically surveillance devices, but then they'll watch YouTube videos on conspiracy theories and music videos and so on for 4 hours a day. Well, isn't YouTube tracking them and their IP address? Well, of course it is. And isn't that data being sold and distributed just like the data from Facebook? And it's all like, yes, it is, because YouTube's owned by Google. And so, it raises all these questions, like exactly what are we trying to get away from? And how much are we willing to do in a full spectrum surveillance system? And so it's like we all end up being hypocrites. I mean, that's where it's come to some degree. Like, in other words, you can say, you know, well, Charles, you're objecting to the full spectrum, you know, surveillance state, but you're using the internet to distribute your ideas. So aren't you part of the matrix? And then the answer is, well, yes, I am. And it's like, well, why is that? You're a hypocrite. And I go, well, what other means do I have left now? I can print a flyer and I can take it out to the corner and I can pass it out to the few pedestrians that might walk by. I mean, what other option do I have outside of the matrix? And so if you say I'm going to be anonymous, I'm going to have a pen name or, is it really impossible for somebody to track you down? I'm not sure. You know, I'm not an expert in that, but they're collecting data on you one way or the other, unless you have literally no digital presence, and then you're silent. And so there's a trade-off there. So if every one of us who's an outsider or who objects to the system or has some other idea of the right way to live, if we're going to cut ourselves off, well, then we go silent. And so then is that really a positive for us in society? I can't tell you that there's a right way or an ethical way to deal with this. Again, it falls back onto every individual. If somebody feels safer or they feel that their quality of life is higher by some level of anonymity, I would say, yeah, go for it. I mean, a lot of people use, they don't want to use Gmail or the regular email because they want it encrypted and so on. And so that's perfectly fine. But I don't think it's changing the nature of how we live. You know, that adjustment is always going to be partial unless you literally cut yourself off from the internet entirely.
Yeah, the irony is the more you cut yourself off, the more you're drawing attention to yourself. It's interesting. I interviewed a member of Extinction Rebellion. They're a pretty extremist environmental group, and their policy in regarding operational security is to do everything in the open. The more open, the less they think they're watched. It's pretty interesting, especially because their groups are penetrated by intelligence agencies and whatnot. So they almost think the more out in the open they do everything, then it's almost like they're more, like you said, going gray. They're just kind of floating behind it in the mass of everything, which is an interesting, regardless of your opinions on their anarchist type movements, but it's an interesting strategy. Do you ever not, like, how far is your Overton window in your writing? I mean, is there, you know, you said you have friends who are conspiratorial. Some of the topics you talk about lend into the conspiratorial. So where's your limits? Or where are there things you're just not interested in? Or where do you limit yourself? Or have you been censored? Or what are your experiences with the surveillance state in that sense?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. And thank you for asking it. I was shadow banned in 2016. I was put on this completely fake list that was page one, Washington Post. I think it was called Prop or Not. In other words, were these sites propaganda sites for Russian intelligence or not? And then they just threw in a couple of hundred of those of us in the alternative media, and basically branded us as propagandists. And so, and then that affected my traffic and stuff. And I think there's other evidence. People have sent me screenshots of like Department of Commerce sites where they were trying to go through to my site at work in a federal agency. And it was, and that my site was blocked as dangerous. So there's, and of course the whole beauty of shadow banning is if you're shadow banned on a site like Facebook, you're not going to know that no one can see your posts. You see it. So you think everybody, all your friends and everything can see it, but no, they allow you to see your post, but then you don't know whether anybody else is able to see it or not. So this brings up another topic of related, which is self-censorship. And I think this is part of what you're asking about is once we realize that we're being surveilled and that access to our site, our posts might be limited because we're outside the official Overton window. Then we start going, well, if you really push too hard, you get demonetized. And in other words, that's another element here we're talking about. Those of us who derive any income from being online and having commentary or podcasts or videos, well, then if they kick you off the platform that you depend on for your money, then you're now broke. So you have been eliminated as a threat, not just digitally, but now you're struggling to pay your bills. So that's a pretty big hammer. If you can demonetize your opponents or, you know, so-called threats, that removes them much more profoundly than just like cutting off their digital account, which they can open on Rumble or some other site, right? So once you've taken away their income, you've really crippled them. So that's happened to a lot of people. And because once, you know, people used to make quite a bit of money on YouTube, for example, or off advertising, well, the platforms took most of the money, you know, like where people used to make like a couple $1,000s a month in advertising revenues. And then the platforms took most of that away in the last decade. So now they get maybe a couple $100 or, you know, you read these stories where you get 1 million downloads on a music site and you know, your royalty check is like $17. And so it's that's part of self-censorship is whatever you're using to make money is always at threat. You know, like you can be banned or dropped. And when this happens to you, you're not told why. And this is the kind of Kafka-esque aspect of full spectrum surveillance is you're simply notified that you violated their community rule or whatever they call it. And you're not told exactly what you did to violate their rules. And you're not given any chance to contest that. Like there's no quasi-judicial thing where you get to say, well, wait a minute, I want to state my case. You know, I want a review. And so this is what makes it so Kafkaesque is that there's layers of authority that you have no access to, and you don't even know who's in charge, but you have no access to who's decided that your site's violated the community rules. So this creates an environment where if you're making money off of it, then you do need to think about what happens if you go outside the approved Overton window. I myself think more about what am I able to contribute. In other words, if am I an expert on something, or am I just another person with another opinion? Everybody's got a right to post whatever they want, but if I'm trying to create value, then I've got to have something outside the normal kind of opinions that get bantered around or get repeated as sort of conventional wisdom or unconventional wisdom. So I think I try to choose topics about which, if I'm not an expert, I feel that I have something different to say. A lot of what people write about, I don't have any insight or expertise in that. So I don't feel that I'm adding any value with some personal view, which might be really poorly grounded, you know? So I try to write about things that I've read deeply about or thought deeply about or about personal experiences where, as somebody said, we are experts in our own experience.
Charles, maybe we can jump for a second on when we first started the conversation, you said that some of my interviews are outside the funnel.
Yes.
What do you think about narrative control and psychological operations in terms of what is funneled up and what's funneled down? I mean, you have the experience with the shadow banning. I find your writing pretty, I'm not going to say vanilla, but it seems very in the middle of what's allowable in terms of critiquing the regime or critiquing society. So I'm actually surprised that you're shadow banned, but I guess some of your financial statistics might counter official numbers and whatnot. So I'm curious, my two questions are, what do you think about just narrative control, if it's coming from corporate narrative control or the governmental narrative control? And secondly, how do you help navigate what's real in a post-truth internet hyper-novel reality and how people can learn to actually read through the lines and things?
Yeah, that's a wonderful topic, post-truth. It's, again, one of the degradations or decay of what we once took for granted as legitimate or authentic. And of course, when we talk about post-truth, we often end up talking about science. I majored in philosophy in university, but I took a lot of math and science in high school. And if you sort of have a fundamental grasp of sort of the basics of math and science, then you can learn and add on to that. In other words, it's not just what you learned in high school or university. Once you kind of grasp the scientific method and the way that statistics are gathered and massaged, then you can add a tremendous body of knowledge, about science. And so that's kind of been one of my life purposes, is to add to the knowledge I started with. So in other words, if you learn the principles of collecting data and the scientific method and what evidence there is and testing a hypothesis and all these elements, then you can apply those to all sorts of situations. And the same is true of philosophy, in the sense that, what is philosophy? Well, you can get 1,000 answers, but I think philosophy is really an attempt to structure thinking skeptically. In other words, really the core of philosophy is to learn to think critically, as we say nowadays, which is to examine a proposal or a body of knowledge and ask what are its agendas, what are its foundational beliefs or claims, and then subject those claims to a rigorous analysis and potentially criticism, or look for elements that actually support it, and so on. So this kind of critical thinking is what when we lack it or we don't understand it, we don't know how to use those principles, then we become prone to being whipsawed by narrative control, as you say. And I think that it's interesting because as you mentioned, the conspiracy theories, my interest is, sort of as kind of vanilla, if you will, to use your word, in that there's clear proof of conspiracies, such as like Big Tobacco obscured the fact that smoking was really unhealthy. And there's been also similar kinds of investigations of big agriculture colluding to price fix. And, there's lots of conspiracy things turn out to be true where there's a commercial interest and so on. There's a lot of conspiracy theories about, the Bilderberg Group or, the World Economic Forum controlling the narrative control globally. And I am skeptical of that all of our problems can be distilled down to the room with 12 evil people. I think that actually, as a general rule, humans respond in the very short term, just kind of more or less keep everything glued together in the moment. And I don't think that the leadership is really that far away from that contingent kind of response. And so a lot of narrative control in the tech world is simply the algorithms, right? Somebody's tweaked the algorithm or reprogrammed the algorithm to eliminate, you know, hot button topics or things that are considered signs of, you know, fake news, et cetera, et cetera. And so, in other words, I don't think that there's a master plan necessarily at work. I think that a lot of it is just people trying to keep everything glued together. And so a lot of the narrative control boils down to that. Keyword, locating keywords and deleting posts that have the keyword and looking for pornographic photos and deleting them and, you know, all this kind of automated stuff. So there's a lot of the narrative control is on that level, that it's not really thoughtful. It's just automated, right? In terms of the higher narrative control, I think we've entered an era where artifice and manipulation are what are viewed by those who have the power economically and politically as essential tools to keep the thing glued together. In other words, like the narrative control that inflation is near zero again, it's only 2 or 3%, or it's like 3%, and that the economy's growing wonderfully. This is a higher level narrative control that's clearly being scripted by human beings. Right now, it may be enforced automated with automated tools, but it's originating in an agenda run by human beings who are trying to keep the thing glued together, because they're obviously concerned that if the official inflation statistic came out at what it really is, like 9% or something, that then people would panic and they demand some action, or, you know, that the system might destabilize under their watch. And so that's not what they want. So therefore, they, you know, gin up these statistics, it's 3%, and tell everybody everything's going great, even though people's own experiences, their financial security is decaying, their quality of life is eroding, et cetera, et cetera. So there's that level of narrative control. So how do we navigate that? I kind of start with the fundamentals, which is, well, you have to be a skeptic, and you have to have some, preferably some ability to think things through yourself rather than just be whipsawed from some claim that this is true. And then somebody else comes out and say, no, that's fake news. And then you're whipsawed by all these different narratives, each of which is like designed to benefit somebody somewhere, right? So, you know, we ask, well, to whose benefit is it if I believe this or not? And so, how do you navigate a post-truth? Well, you just try to accumulate as much evidence as you can that stands up to your own skeptical inquiry. And this, of course, takes a lot of energy. And it's energy that people don't necessarily have. And so then one way of dealing with that is to just say, you know what, I'm going to kind of shut off the media and focus on my own real life here, because I find this being whipsawed of all this, all these opinions and claims about truth and untruth, to not actually be adding anything to my life. In fact, it's decaying and degrading my mental health. So, to the degree that we don't control a lot of the issues that we're being inundated with, maybe the positive thing is to detach ourselves from the narrative control, focus on stuff we can control.
No, I think it's good. I mean, it's just going back to your original self-reliance point, that just more local, more direct, more grounded in reality. I mean, when you add in the layers of international narrative control, it just becomes so complicated. I mean, it's easy. I have friends in Venezuela, for instance, who have left Venezuela. And if you look at Venezuelan state media, you know, everything's going good and everything, you know. And then you see the underground, it's so obvious that the lies are there, right? Because you can clearly understand the reality. But here in the West, you know, if the case of Ukraine or COVID or China, even the thing what you just said about the Chinese credit score system, even that is unknown how real that actually is. Because I talked to friends in Shanghai and they're like, I don't know what you're talking about. I've never had any experience with this credit score system. And it almost seems like that's a narrative element from Western propaganda against China. I have no real opinion because I don't face that system. But like you said, I think that the summary of the point is going back to the local, to the grounded. If the government says inflation's at zero, but you see the eggs going up, whatever, 10%, I think that's, you know, you have to start asking questions, right? I wanted to ask what you thought, Charles, on your concept about tight, loose ambidexterity. You termed that in one of your essays on what's the roadmap for what's ahead. And I wanted to offer listeners, maybe how do you look towards the future? How do you keep, I guess, philosophically ambiguous? And how do you move forward? And what are you seeing the next kind of themes for the next few years in your analysis?
Well, thank you for that. The idea of tight and loose cultures has been around for quite a while. The idea being that cultures can be tight in the sense that they demand obedience and to like social mores and social rules, as well as obedience to authority. And then the loose culture has a broader sense of freedom of social, what's socially acceptable, less strict compliance with authority. And so the studies that have been done sociologically have found that these types of cultures, of course, are a spectrum, right? There's not just one or the other. It's like, of course, a spectrum, but that it doesn't relate to geographics or the development, the economic status of the country. Like for the paper I referenced, or the article I referenced, said that both Japan and Pakistan tend to be on the tight culture end of the spectrum, even though they're completely different in so many other ways. And where the loose culture spectrum is more like the US and Brazil, which are completely different countries, right? Different histories. The idea being that cultures become tight as a means of surviving a lot of natural disasters or a lot of crises that really demand cooperation of everybody to get through it. And then the looser cultures have fewer threats to their existence, and so they can have a more individualistic approach, and the cooperation is always more difficult or contested, right? There's individual advocacy and individualism is the core of the looser cultures. Social acceptability is the core of the tight cultures, right? You need to fit in, will not be approved of. The idea being that these two types of cultures provide what we might call like selected natural selection. They offer better or worse survival skills, right? In other words, each loose and tight both offer advantages when faced with crisis or challenges or threats. And so the idea of ambidextry cultures is that if you can shift from a loose culture to a tight culture in crisis so that you can create cooperation as opposed to just conflict, then you're going to get over the crisis far more successfully. And then you can loosen back up. That's being ambidextrous, if you will. Whereas if you just go down the road of tightening and it becomes a feedback loop where you know, those in authority just keep tightening and tightening and tightening, like the only thing they know how to do as things continue to fray or fall apart is impose even more centralized control, then you end up creating a feedback loop that's like not cooperative. It's more like then people start dropping out or opting out, or they start resisting that level of tightening. Or you can go looser and looser, and then you lose the ability to cooperate on a mass scale at all. And so, in other words, you just kind of devolve. Extremely localized communities, and there's no cooperation at all at a larger scale. So I think that's useful for us in a way that I would call scale invariant, meaning that I think that mechanism is valuable on it from the individual level to the household, to the larger family, to the community, to the state, the city, or to the nation state. You know, it works on all levels. So that even as individuals, we can see the advantage of kind of tightening up and sacrificing our own personal goals for the good of the household, for instance. And then once we've overcome some crisis or challenge, then we can kind of loosen up and go back to, you know, being able to focus on ourselves. So I think that in the larger scope of things, sympathetic to the analysts who say none of this matters. The only thing that matters is energy and the biosphere. In other words, we can dance around surveillance and narratives and all that stuff, but it really boils down to how much energy do we have access to and at what price, and what is that doing to the biosphere? And so in that larger scope, we obviously need to use less of everything. That's like the essential goal of everything we're doing is to have a high quality of life, what I call well-being, by using less of everything on a massively less. In other words, not just we're going to reduce usage by 2%, but we need to like use like half of what we're doing in terms of materials and energy. And so from this point of view, people talk about, well, the elites and the, you know, are supposed to be the bad guys and all this. And the elites are not the issue. It's that we're running out of cheap energy at the level that we need to keep growing the economy globally. And that the more we grow the economy, the more we destroy the biosphere. And that's the core issue for humanity. And that everything that's happening is a reflection of that. So resource wars, you know, social conflicts, decline in the quality of life, et cetera, all really go, all come back to that. We can say in that sense, we need to cooperate at a level we haven't been able to achieve globally, right? And how do we do that? And ironically, perhaps one answer is we just try to lower our own footprint on the planet, right? In other words, by relocalizing our life, then we're actually lightening the footprint of humanity, because, you know, if we can grow our own food locally, just to some degree, then it means we're using less energy to fly food 2,500 miles or 5,000 miles, and that kind of thing. And the idea that this actually increases the quality of our life and our well-being, then it's like, well, that's a win-win-win, right? And so that's where relocalization seems to be an answer on multiple levels that we can actually participate in. You know, we can't really influence whether the world can pump 95 million barrels of oil a day or not, or whether it slips to 85 or increases to 100 million. You know, we don't really control that output, but we can control what happens, you know, in our local communities to some degree. And so that's where relocalization seems like the answer to multiple issues.
I think, Charles, it comes back to your theme of just keep, you know, the 30 people is the most important thing versus the 30 bunkers or whatnot, because it's interesting because you're writing, I could imagine people on the right getting frustrated and mad because some of your arguments sound almost leftist, right? They're, you know, degrowth, environmentalism. These are all kind of leftist talking points. So I'm interested. It's interesting how you jump between the left and right. I always appreciate that. You're just trying to be honest, I guess, with the problems and the challenges. But either if you are on the left or right, I guess the message is just more local, more control of your individual actions and reactions. Charles, I don't want to take too much of your time, but one of the things I was really interested in was why you write fiction. I only read two of your short stories, and there's another writer, you probably know, James Kunstler, who writes fiction as well. And he writes a lot about financial collapse and collapse studies. And John Michael Greer also writes fiction. So I'm curious, why do you write fiction? And then what are you trying to do with it? I think, is there an optimism you're trying to model? Or what are you doing with your fiction? And how does that offer a contrast to your nonfiction work?
Well, you're asking a question that every writer loves to express themselves on, right? I do admire the work of Jim and John Michael Greer. But I have read some of Kunstler's fiction. I'm aware that Greer also writes fiction. I've read his nonfiction books. I think it's a question that any creator can answer, whether it's a musician, podcaster, video artist, is you're drawn to, you typically are drawn to both aspects of of creation, like a documentarian kind of approach, if you will. And then the fictional expression of some theme that you want to develop that only fiction or that fictional art allows you to do. In other words, you could create characters out of thin air and have them face challenges and so on. And so I think one of the motivators for me was I've written a bunch of novels and each one was an exploration of a different genre. So I, like, for instance, I wrote a book, the Consulting Philosopher, and my idea was, well, I wanted to write a mystery. And because I like philosophy, then I created this character who's a consulting philosopher, which of course is ludicrous, but it was a fictional way I could combine my interest in philosophy with like writing a mystery, which is a particular form and a challenge, right? So I've written romances, if you will, and a road novel and an AI related sort of novel. And so I've written a bunch of different things, more as self-expression than anything else. But in terms of the development of myself as a writer and an individual, each of these novels has given me a chance to develop or express some interest of mine that then gets fulfilled in writing the book. And I presume it's the same for poets, filmmakers, documentarians. Everybody probably shares those ideas or values. They want to explore an idea that fascinates them, and they want to reach culmination, or they want to complete that interest.
Just the last question on the fiction writing. What's your approach to writing fiction, and how is it different to nonfiction? I mean, do you have a different bracket of time you schedule for it, or how do you jump into, say, writing a romance novel?
Yeah, that's interesting. I tend to have ideas that I've thought about for many years that seem to be worth developing, you know, in a fiction. So I'll think about characters and setups. And I wrote a lot of screenplays too back in the 90s. And, you know, I had a Hollywood agent for a while, and he was pitching them and nothing transpired. Like, you know, it's like most of us, right? That, you know, literally 99% of us write novels and screenplays and they don't get any traction in the larger culture. Screenplays teach you a different way of kind of fiction writing, in that you're basically setting a scene, right? So you're writing it as you would film it. So there's got to be a mise-en-scène, you know, a setup for the physical location, and then, you know, you describe the characters interacting and the dialogue. So that teaches you a different kind of structure for writing a novel. So I think I follow that kind of screenplay, how shall I call it, structure. But it's mostly the exploration of a theme, of some larger theme. And so, like, say, for instance, my romance, it's called Verona in Spring. And it's the setup that was interesting to me was a young woman approaching 30 who has several suitors. But it's like, what are the trade-offs in her life between trying to stay single and like losing these suitors as they go off to find somebody else to get married to? And then, well, who should she choose? And of course, it's the main character's a female, but the same issue is, of course, universal in human life. And so it's that sense of there's all these trade-offs, and how do you navigate that, especially if you're poor, like, you know, you're low income, you know? So there's this whole economic element to relationships and your choices in life that we don't talk about so much, right? We talk about romantic love, but there's also you're forming a partnership with somebody, and what are the costs and benefits to that? And then there's sort of an element of when you're running out of your youth, then you're, as in Japan they call it Christmas cake, right? That women who aren't married by 30 become less desirable. So there's this time element. So those were the themes that I wanted to explore. So that's
I think those themes are probably in your nonfiction writing on finance. You're writing about the same things, making choices, making trade-offs, you know, risks, rewards, liberty, freedom, constraint.
Yeah, that's right. That's very insightful. And I'm glad you read my little story about falling in love with a homeless woman, because it's so counter to everything that we're told or what we experience, because of course many homeless people are not necessarily very pleasant to interact with, but that's not 100%, right? There's a lot of diversity in the homeless population as well. So I wanted to explore that. And as you say, there's a certain sort of hope there on multiple levels.
Yeah, I think that's interesting, because when I compare, I haven't read all of Kunstler's writing, but his, of what I understand, his model making for the world, I mean, it is localized, but it seems darker and colder and less optimistic. So I'm curious if your fiction is just kind of you're trying to model something for what another alternative reality could be.
Yeah, I probably don't have as coherent a vision as Jim, but that I think that I am. I do try to express that I think there is a lot of hope ahead and opportunity, but it's not in the conventional sort of narratives that we're exposed to.
Charles, is there anything else you want to share today? Or I think I want listeners to take away the message that a lot about finance, but I think there's an optimism about returning to a local and individualized kind of self-driven solution or reliance. Is there anything else you want to share for people?
I would just say, I think that there's something about authenticity that's really valuable, but it's something that we've sort of lost the ability to value it and nurture it. And then what we're presented with largely is artifice. And so that hollows us out on so many levels to live in a life that we don't control very much, and that it's largely artifice or superficial or sensationalized. And so that hollows us out and makes us impoverished in so many ways. And so really everything I'm writing about is to try to return to whatever's authentic and has integrity. I think that's the wealth of life. I write about finance because that's also important. We need shelter and we need some sense of security. And so I try to combine those and say, well, if you can control your income and the way that you make money and your livelihood, then the ideal is to become authentic in the way that you make money as well as the way you live.
And then, Charles, my last question is, what's your advice for people how do they find their authentic self? I mean, that's a hard thing to find.
Yeah. And I'm smiling because it's an ongoing process. I mean, I'm 70 and I'm still performing that search myself, right? It's a constant questioning. What's authentic for me now? Because we all change and we adapt. So being adaptable and flexible about who we are is, I think, something to keep asking ourselves. And we just have to experiment and try things. We don't really know until we try it.
Great. I think we can end with that point, Charles. I really appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you.